Juno Afternoon is made possible with support from Sentinel Coffee, serving Southeast with locally roasted organic coffee and door-to-door delivery. More at sentinelcoffee.com. Our first guests on today's show are with Alaska Electric Light and Power, and they're here to tell us about the flume, the history, its function, and when it will reopen for walkers. We have Debbie Driscoll. She's the vice president and a director of consumer affairs. Welcome to the show, Debbie. Nice to have you.
Thanks for having me.
And Brian Farrell. He's a mechanical engineer and assistant generation engineer as well. Brian, welcome to the show. It's nice to have you both here. I think we know a lot about AELNP, Debbie, but just to give our listeners a reminder, how many folks does AELNP serve here in Juneau?
Well, we basically serve everyone. However, if we're looking at locations, customer locations, we serve about 17,100 customers, give or take.
Got it. And yeah, a little bit about the history. Remind me when the company was started.
1893. We celebrated our 125th anniversary last year.
Okay.
Yeah.
And where is the power coming from these days? We know Snettisham is the big one, right?
Right, right. So, yeah, Snettisham serves, provides about 70% of our hydro. So we have five hydro plants. We have Snettisham, we have Lake Dorothy, Annex Creek, and Salmon Creek, and Gold Creek.
Got it. And we are going to get to the flume in a minute, but I had a couple other questions. I hope you don't mind.
Not at all.
We hear a lot of things about interruptible customers. Mm-hmm. You talked about the 17,000 households. How do they relate to interruptible, and what's all that about?
Well, numerous years ago, we entered into agreements with Greens Creek Mine, Princess Cruise Ships, and customers who have multiple heating sources to buy surplus energy. Essentially, that means energy that might otherwise spill and not be utilized. So we're in a really unique situation here in Juneau where we have customers who have their own generation, or their, in the case of what we call our dual fuel customers, they have their own multiple sources of heat, but they are able to buy surplus energy from us. And the benefit of that is, one, they of course get to use 100% renewable hydropower when they're using our surplus energy. But the revenue from that sale, those sales go directly to our customers, and they reduce the amount that the rest of us pay. So a good comparison to that is if you had a home and you had a couple extra rooms and you rented them out, those renters would help you pay your mortgage. And when you need the full space, those renters go away, and then you pay the full price of your mortgage on your own. So that's a benefit.
All right. How about the cruise ships? How many of those are hooking up to our power these days?
I don't have an exact number, but I believe that about a third of the capable cruise ships plug in to our system.
And capable?
Meaning that they have the capacity.
Got it.
To plug in.
Okay. You mentioned something about the quality of the power coming from these renewable sites. I know that Snettisham is it called a lake tap project?
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean? And yeah.
So I'll talk a little bit, but Brian might actually have more information to share. But essentially, we have mountain lakes, and we tap into the lake from, you know, through the bedrock, essentially, right? And you have the gravity that basically creates this head that allows for the force of the hydro coming down the pipeline, or right, the penstock, to then spin our turbines, which then generates electricity. So because of the elevation of these mountain lakes, we get this, you know, the ability for the water to turn our turbines. So it's unique to this area. I'm sure there are other places that have mountain lakes, but for us, it's unique. But I bet Brian can actually say a little bit more about that.
Lake tap being a little different than like a dam. So we actually go in and penetrate the side or bottom of the lake to pull water out of there rather than to build a dam with a conduit coming out of that.
Got it. And was Snettisham, as an example, maybe mid-century Army Corps of Engineers?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep.
I've had a chance to be out there, and you know, the whole control room it's like a scene out of a James Bond movie, right? It's under the mountain.
Absolutely. I like to call it the Batcave.
It's pretty extraordinary. And just even the transmission line, the 138 kV transmission line that was built alongside, you know, on this mountainous terrain that just drops directly, you know, avalanche prone, you know, it's just insane what they did, and they just did it so well. So it's really extraordinary to see.
Got it. And you said Snettisham is about 70?
About 70% of our hydro comes from Snettisham. And then about 17% comes from Lake Dorothy. Lake Dorothy came online in 2009. It provides about 14 megawatts of capacity to our system. And then Salmon Creek is about 6%. And Annex Creek is about 6%. And Gold Creek, which we'll be talking about shortly, is about 1%.
Got it. All right. I think a lot of people want to know about the flume. I'm a big flume walker myself. I love to go up there and do a loop here out of downtown. Let's go back to its inception. What was it for, Brian?
So it was for water conveyance for hydroelectric power generation. It's been its purpose since inception.
Got it. And about what year did that start?
So the first flume originally was 1896 in one fashion. The flume as you know it today was built over 1912, 1913.
Wow. That's a long time.
Yes.
So water conveyance, I think a lot of us have gotten on up near Basin Road before, there where Gold Creek comes out. And somewhere in there is the water diverted into the flume, I guess.
Yeah. So right after the man gate for the and next to the Mount Roberts Trail there, the road dips down right to the creek and there's a intake to the flume right there with a trash rack on it to keep some of the debris out of it.
Got it. And how much water is that capable? So, okay, give us a visual. We've all walked on top and have sensed, I think, that there's water below us, that there's a pipe. What's it all look like?
That's just a box. It's a big wooden box made of tongue and groove. Standard Douglas fir puts about 30 CFS, cubic feet per second, to the forebay. And when it enters the forebay, that's where we have another trash rack to pull leaves and sticks out of that. And then it enters the penstock down to the powerhouse, and that's where we develop our pressure.
Got it. And the powerhouse, describe where that is. Is that by Salvation Army?
That's right behind Salvation Army, yes.
Got it. And remind me, Debbie, about how much power comes out of there?
About 1%.
1%.
So, and Gold Creek is run of the river. So that's a little bit different. It's not, there's no storage there. So in a dry winter, you're not going to get the run of the river. But in a summer with heavy rains or with a lot of melt, you're going to get quite a bit. But yeah, it's about 1% of our hydro generation.
All right. So as you mentioned, the current version, or what was the current version before the summer, was built in about 1912, 1913.
Yep.
I guess we can imagine what inspired some upgrades, but can you describe what you've been doing up there?
The upgrades really, if we're talking about upgrades, are to the trestles themselves, the bridges that the flume runs across. The box itself, the flume itself, is going to be like in kind. We're going back with basically the exact same thing.
Wow. And does it all have to be replaced, all that tongue and groove? I mean, it must need replacing,
yes, yes.
Right?
I mean, that has been replaced in bits and pieces and repaired over the years. But I think those of us that walk it regularly, you can see that it was in terrible need of some TLC, especially in the bridge areas where it was bending and leaning.
Okay. So correct me if I'm wrong, but it seemed like this started about back in May or June.
It was April when we started.
April?
This year.
Okay. So where are you now in the scope of the project?
We are cleaning up. We will have that thing back and walkable on Monday.
What? So 1 week from today, back on the flume.
For phase one.
For phase one.
Phase one.
Oh, okay. We shouldn't get our hopes up too high. So we'll be able to walk, it sounds like, here through the fall until it gets avalanche-y or has potential, and then maybe we shouldn't be on it, right? And then what's going to happen?
Well, let me explain a little bit about the current situation. So we've gone through and removed the lower half, the half towards Evergreen, and removed that box completely. We've rebuilt the bridges, which is what took us most of the time this year. That trail will be somewhat on the new trestles with the old flume sidewalls as the decking temporarily and temporary handrails. Some of that trail will be right on rock that we've laid down to try and make it a nice trail for people that are on it. And some of that will be on the actual flume base that's still laying on the ground.
Interesting. And you brought me a couple images, and folks, I'll put these at ktoo.org/JunoAfternoon after our show today so you can see, get a preview for the flume opening in a week. Describe what we're looking at here.
So what you're looking at there is what was formerly what we called Trestle 3. That used to be a bridge. We've gone through and made an earthen wall, a sill out of that because of the location. We had concerns about the stability of that trestle. So what you're looking at there is that new sill in place with handrails just to keep that safe for the public. And then on the foreground of that is some of that rock we've laid down for people to walk on.
Got it. And is the flume under this rock? Or
the flume will lay right on top of that. So that will be the base elevation for the new flume.
Okay. I see. All right. So this is going to open on Monday. And then what's the timeline look like after that?
We will get back into that in April of next year, and it'll be a similar timeline to this year. We plan on being complete by about October of 2020. So this year we did the trestles. Next year we will do the box in its entirety.
Wow. What have been some challenges for you guys?
Oh, I can't say we've had a lot of challenges with this one. We've had some material delays here and there, but while it's been hot and dry, and that's not necessarily great for reservoirs, it's been great for construction. So it's actually been a wonderful year up there.
Oh, good. Speaking of low water and droughts and low rain, even though in the forecast I hear big rain tomorrow.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah, right?
Sorry, folks.
So is it Long Lake that feeds Snettisham? Is that what it's called? Or
that's one of
both
them.
Both Long Lake and Crater Lake.
Got it. How are their levels looking right now?
So we had some good rain recently, which was helpful. Our reservoirs are above where we were last year, but we're still below normal. So we're at about 85% of normal out at Snettisham. So we still have our interruptible customers disconnected to preserve hydro for our firm customers. We anticipate being able to supply all of our firm customers throughout fall and winter with hydro. We have not burned diesel for our firm customers. For that, we've been able to supply, unlike some of the other southern communities in Southeast that haven't been as fortunate. But we've been fortunate to be able to supply all of our, you know, firm customers with hydro. It's a balancing act, right? Like knowing when to sell surplus energy to the interruptible customers because it provides a credit to our customers, and knowing when to curtail them to preserve hydro for future use. So we're looking at that and adjusting it all the time.
Power forecasting in a sense, right?
It's power forecasting. And of course, then you have, you know, rain forecasting, which we know isn't an exact science. So we just do our best to make the right decision. And we tend to be conservative because we want to make sure that we have hydro to meet all of our firm customers' needs and that we won't need to supplement with diesel.
So that's something we probably haven't thought too much about, is this challenge of forecasting for power and thinking about rain and lake levels. What are other challenges we might not know about in the electricity industry?
Well, you know, we're an isolated grid, right? We're not connected to a grid outside of Juneau, so we are entirely independent on our, you know, reliant on ourselves. So we have this amazing system of hydro, right? We're 100% renewable. We've been 100% renewable before it was cool to be 100% renewable. But we also have 100% diesel backup. So in the case like when the avalanches occurred in 2008 and 2009, we have this ability to get everyone back on with diesel backup. And in a perfect world, we don't have to use diesel, you know, very much. We get to rely on our hydro when we get normal rain. But, you know, yeah, basically it's conditions like that. Avalanche, certainly we've come really far in our avalanche mitigation. We have the Daisy Bell. We are one of the first in the world to use the Daisy Bell for avalanche mitigation. At least in the U.S. we were. I know they were using them in France, especially in the ski areas.
And remind our listeners, if they don't know what a Daisy Bell is, how
that
works.
Sure. It's a contraption basically that slings and hangs from a helicopter. It shoots hydrogen and oxygen, I guess. Yeah. And you can put it right above, like a foot above the snowpack, and you create controlled releases so that you are managing the releases so that hopefully it doesn't become an actual issue that could possibly take out our towers. It's a little better than tossing dynamite up the hill and hoping for the best. So, yeah.
I have a question for you, Brian, as a mechanical engineer and assistant generation engineer. I get really afraid when I'm near my electric box just at my house, which has 110 and 220. You know, just those wires. You have to take it off sometimes and you see these wires. Tell us about some of the power sources that you're near and how you guys stay safe.
So we have a very extensive safety program. We do go through regular training to remind our guys minimum approach distances and everything like that. But we also make sure that we do all our work on de-energized equipment. So we go through lockout tag-out procedures to make sure that all of our guys are safe.
Got it. So often when we see a person working up on a line, that line has been circumvented.
Yep.
All right. That makes me feel better. If you're just tuning in, we're speaking with Brian Farrell and also Debbie Driscoll. They're both from AELNP. And you heard it here that the Flume will be back open for walking a week from today.
Correct.
Are we going to see any other what other differences might we see as we walk?
For this one, you'll see some differences in the layout. We've had to remove some vegetation from the uphill side, just mostly danger trees to keep things out of the way. And we were fortunate in this way to be able to use modern equipment to do this because they didn't have excavators and loaders and things back in the day. So we've beefed up those trestle bridges to be able to actually walk equipment across them. So you may notice that those are more substantial than they used to be.
Okay. And before I was talking about the Flume and winter travel a little bit, Debbie, you know, I've always wondered about that. You know, as we get a big snowpack there on Mount Juneau, should we be concerned, you know, about walking on the Flume in the winter? Is that an okay question for you guys, or should I talk to our city manager or someone?
Well, so they put out a forecast about the hazard, you know, mm-hmm. the risk level of avalanche. Is it a high risk? Is it a low risk? And so we would certainly encourage – I mean, we look at that regularly. We would certainly encourage anyone who's going to walk in that area to check the forecast before doing so. Just to stay safe. I mean, it's Juneau. We don't. It's such a science with, you know, avalanches and you know, if the sun hit it and then if it froze. And I mean, there's just so much to it. So sometimes you think it looks like it would be safe, but it might not be. So again, that forecast would be a good idea to check.
All right, good answer. And then just future projects. You mentioned some of our power sites already, Snettisham, Lake Dorothy, a couple others. Do you have plans to bring any more online?
So we have projects that can be developed. As you know, hydro is really expensive to build and all the cost is associated right up front. We were really lucky when we brought Lake Dorothy online because Greens Creek was able to say, hey, we'll take surplus energy as your firm customers grow into the need. Most places, most utilities don't have that ability. So we were really fortunate that way. But you know, with hydro, you want to get right size at the right time, because if you build too much too soon, you burden the ratepayers, the customers, with higher rates. So if you can't sell all of that energy, the per kilowatt hour charge, you know, if you can only sell half of it, it doubles the cost. So it's always a balancing act. And of course, you have to plan 3, 4, 5 years in advance. But yes, we do have different sizes hydro projects that we can build when it makes sense to do so and when it's in the community's interest to do so.
All right. That's the voice of Debbie Driscoll, Vice President and Director of Consumer Affairs. And Brian Farrell is also on the show. He's a mechanical engineer and assistant generation engineer. The Flume opens a week from today. Thank you both for being on the show. Anything else that you'd like to add?
No, just thank you for having us. And I did want to just remind folks that we post reservoir updates and information, outage information, all of that to our website, aelp.com, but also on our social media, Facebook and Twitter. And we try to do a good job of getting that information out there so folks don't have to wonder about
it.
Right. So just a reminder for folks.
Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
She's electric. She's in a family.